Hello and welcome to the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann, a listener-supported program. This episode is a continuation of the Faith and Earth Care series. This time, I speak with Kelly Ware, a permaculturist from Montana, with one of the oldest known permaculture sites in that state. We talk about her thoughts on the idea of permaculture and the kingdom, bringing together the practices and practitioners of the Christian faith with permaculture. Whereas the first in this series, my conversation with Ramiz Kent, was a more secular look at the elements of earth care within Islam, this conversation with Kelly is interwoven with her personal story of moving from a place of non-belief to one of faith, and then to how we can do more to connect with others and build community across our lines of belief. I enjoyed myself quite a bit in this conversation with Kelly, and had a fun time talking about this topic of faith and earth care from such a different perspective. We roamed all over the place in our conversation, and I'm thankful that for all the sideline questions I asked, things came together nicely in the end. You'll find links with more information on how to connect with Kelly in the show notes. If you enjoy this interview or any other episodes in the growing archive, help me reach the goal of releasing at least 75 episodes in 2014 by making a donation to the show. Your support is the only financial means of making that happen, and supporting the show helps me invest in other projects such as the Traveling Permaculture Library, or simply being able to hire a friend of mine who's a photographer to join me and help document different events. Find out how to help at www.thepermaculturepodcast.com/support. Now then, on to Kelly Ware. I'll join you again afterwards with my thoughts and some updates. Well then, Kelly, if you are ready, could you give us a little bit of your background, biography, how you came to permaculture, and we can take the conversation from there.
Thanks. I was fortunate enough to be born in Southern California to a family where my dad was the builder, owner, and operator of the largest picnic park resort in Southern California. So I had the benefit of growing up under cottonwood trees, and think picnic was our motto, and people would come and stay all summer long and trade for helping with catering lines, and we'd serve company picnics out of L.A. and the public up to 7,000 people in a day, and normal weekend days were 3,500 people. So I grew up in nature, and I had such a hard time going into school in the winter times. I would go fly home to my mom's in Idaho, and we had moved to Jackson Hole and then moved over to Idaho with my mom's remarriage, and so we were plopped right into the middle of potato farmland, flat, kind of dreary winters, and I was like one of 32 cheerleaders that was not Mormon. So, I mean, it was all Mormon community. They were all my best friends, but I grew up always being the Californian or the outsider and seeing religion from the outside looking at it and growing up with some frustrations there. I went off to California as soon as I could, and Northern California, I was at UC Santa Cruz, and population really bothered me, and I did a massage school up in Northern California, Heartwood, and they grew all their own food, and everything was really natural and amazing. After that, it was off to Chile, so I checked into a couple years of college down in Santiago, Chile, and I'm fortunate to be fluent in Spanish, Chilean Spanish. And being in a city of 5 million people with the fifth worst pollution in the world in the winter, where you could just shower and it would come off of you, I escaped to the hills of Utah to be a ski instructor and do massage and go through college and be a fun, loving young person out there climbing mountains and having my nature. And I was invited to go down to Moab, Utah to check out a piece of land with a friend. My car was packed up. I was going to go out to Oregon to plant trees and live in the woods. And instead, I followed this mountain climber down south. And we started working on his place. And he had just gone to one class that was in Moab. Somebody came through and taught a straw bale building class. And so from that one class, we started doing a straw bale. Actually, before we started doing the straw bale, we were going to do rock. And that summer we got too hot. It was in Moab, and so we went off to go visit some in-laws in Oryx Island up in the San Juan Islands in northwest Washington state. And we needed a place to stay for the summer. He got a job, and the kid he was working with said, hey, you got to check out this really cool farm. It's a permaculture farm. It's amazing. So the day that we went, which was in Deer Harbor to the Bullocks farm, they were in the middle of a chinampas workshop, and everybody was covered in mud and having fun and playing. And I just walked in and I thought, oh, I'm home. It was so great, just normal, natural people. And we were invited to live there, so we spent the rest of the summer in a pop-up tent. And my daughter at that time, Althea, was 5 months old, just learning how to sit up. And so my job on the farm was to sit under the apple trees and do bud grafting all day long and plant salad greens all day long. And we helped put together the metal structure that became a 50,000-gallon water tank that they use solar panels to take their lowest water before it leaves the property and pump it back up into this huge storage tank so that then it could drip line feed back down through the property to circulate the water. And that was great. We were there and built the first cob oven with people, and it was just so amazing to live in a place where every one of your meals was fresh picked, and together with all the interns, we'd throw in $20 a month for wheat to grind and to make the bread, rice, you know, and sunflower butter, honey, and oil. And that was, we just bought a bulk, and that's just how we ate, and it was just so amazing. And at that time, I was, through the massage school, I'd become involved with the Native American church, and some of that was going on the islands when I went to visit. So that was my spiritual orientation. It was the first time I learned how to pray, was at a prayer meeting, all night long prayer meeting. And we'd been to a few of those by then. And, you know, it was so important sitting around the fire at night on Orcas Island, and the discussion that goes on around the elements, especially fire, is so important. So I was always very spiritually attuned. And then being on Orcas, on the Bullock farm, there was only a solar panel for electricity. There wasn't a big charge of electricity around me. And so it was always really hard when I go into town and I get zapped by all this electrical current. So I've always been, I don't know if it's paranoid or just being able to feel what it feels like to be bombarded by electrical devices and the ferrous grid and stuff like that. So when we went back in the fall to Moab, we couldn't afford the mortgage on our house in town, and so we decided to build this straw bale house out on our land in Castle Valley. And it was a 17-foot diameter, two-story, or with a loft, and we lived there. And I loved the idea of homesteading. It felt really natural, but I realized that we're not meant to homestead alone. We're meant to homestead in community, because having a child, they say, it takes a village to raise a child. And I love the quote somebody said, it takes a village to raise a village, because you can't be 100% responsible. You just wear yourself out doing everything by yourself. I went up to Salt Lake City to move back to someplace where they had a little bit more of an economy. My husband at the time and I just, you know, we felt called to have a baby, but like I said, I wasn't raised in any religion, so I guess I didn't really understand what marriage and family were really about. And we just felt called to have this child, and it was just part of, I guess, our adventuresome spirits, and we were both very kind of, we heeded those feelings. And we had Althea, and just the stress of building a home and two homes, basically, and having a child, and, you know, she's 2.5, you know, I always plug its parents in there. When your kids are little, just stick it through the hard times, because they do pass and kids grow up, and it becomes awesome if you can make it through. Just don't kill each other. And in the house in town too, I built an earth bag wall. The people who wrote the book, Khaki and Donnie, that wrote the book Earth Bag Building, lived down the street from me, and I saw what they were doing, and I thought, oh, that's cool. So I did a straw bale or an earth bag wall in the front of my house in town, and they go up easier than you think if you have time to do it. So I was really into trying to figure out, how are we meant to live naturally? Like, how did God make us to live on this planet? Because stuck in houses surrounded by electricity wasn't it. And so that was kind of my whole goal in having Althea too, is how are we meant to have babies? I remember when I got together with Alex, her dad, at first he said, well, if you get pregnant, you know you're not going to have a hospital birth. I'm like, who are you to tell me what kind of birth I'm going to have? But it was a revolutionary idea. I thought, really? You don't go to the hospital to have a baby? And so anyway, I had a midwife and, you know, had her in my living room. I had all my kids at home, you know, 4 hours, 2 good pushes, 6 hours, all of them, great births. I always preach to people, just don't leave home. It's dangerous to leave home when you're in labor. Anyway, so I also did something really interesting. I've got a podcast at Hermes on infant potty training because I figured out, I heard stories that African women didn't use diapers and they just knew when their baby needed to go pee and because they could tune into that uncomfortable feeling of the child and they just hold over the bush and it goes. And so I did that. I've actually taught it all around the world. And like I said, we do this podcast on it. And I'm just hoping that people will stop using diapers. It's a very permaculture thing to do infant potty training. So there's some good tips for how to just focus your life and figure out, you know, how do I raise kids? The other rite of passage I felt like we did is we built our own home. And we built that straw bale house using nothing more than hand drills and a chainsaw and draw knives. And we went up for $5 wood cutting permit, got wood and did a post and beam frame, hauled in bags of cement and did a foundation and her footer and did that on like $3,000. Everything was used stuff. And I just thought, wow, is this legal? I mean, without a building permit, it wasn't really legal, but otherwise, yeah, it is legal to build your own home. And I thought, gosh, you know, building your own home, having your own child at home, these are rites of passage that have been stolen from us in society. So anyway, I tried to do a farm in Salt Lake. I met someone and we were very inspired by permaculture and went off to Drew Mostentowski's Central Rocky Mountain Permaculture Institute in Basalt, Colorado. And I got my PDC there back in like probably 98. And tried to do a farm in Salt Lake, and again, doing it all by myself, and that didn't work. And then I was up in Park City living again, and I just couldn't get those millionaires to buy into my permaculture development plan. I kind of had this whole Olympic Village idea, and they just couldn't see the value of community and soil. So I started looking north toward where my parents had settled, which is up in the Flathead Valley in northwest Montana. Beautiful lake. We've got the cleanest, largest lake in North America. And the tribe was up here, and I talked to other permaculturalists who had done some training on the tribe. Larry Santoyo was one of them. And I was emailing back and forth, and they said, you don't want to do a project in Park City. It's too high altitude. You should go up to the Flathead. And that was kind of my ticket. And so I went up, and I moved up here. I met my current husband. He's a chiropractor. I'm a deep tissue massage therapist. And so we started a clinic together on the reservation on the south end of the Flathead Lake. And it's gorgeous up here. It's very cold in winter, but gives you time to rest and plan your garden for the next year. There is a lot of good that can happen on tribal reservations, and that's another one of my missions and focuses, getting permaculture into the reservations, because they do share information with each other, and it's so important because they do have a greater sense of tribe and the value of indigenous ways of doing things, the old ways of doing things. So I started my city lot here. I have a double lot, and it's a 12-year permaculture system. I'm sure other people have done stuff like this, but we need to find them in Montana, because people come to me as being the oldest Montana permaculture site, but I'm flattered, but I know it's not true. So we have a lot of fun here. I moved up to my dad's property in Big Fork for a little while and helped him out and built some gardens up there. And in the meantime, before that, I also helped the Catholic Church and one of the Universal Churches set up community gardens, because the city wasn't very nice to give us land in Polson, so the church has offered it, and we've got that going. I went through some real personal crossroads in my life, and I had 2 more kids. That's what happened. for 12 years living here, I had 2 more boys back in Dane, and they're growing up now, but again, having young children and starting out was very hard on my new marriage.
I know very much what that idea of transitioning back to raising kids is like. I happened to marry into an existing family when I met my wife because I had a stepdaughter who was almost a teenager. The age range of our children is now 4, 5 and U.S. Marine. And it can be quite a shock as you're making that transition as that only child who is older is moving on to being more and more like their own person and secure in their own place. And then you kind of rock that boat with new kids and have to almost rediscover what it's like to be a parent of small children. I don't know what it is, but in talking with family members when the little ones were born, it seems as if everyone willfully forgets what it's like to have small kids. Those late nights, all that lack of sleep and just wondering, oh, why do you look so bad? I have 2 small kids and I haven't slept in 4 years.
Yeah, and I had a teenager and 2 small children. And I was a single mom too for a while, and I was completely financially self-supportive in that time too. And my heart goes out to any single parent because there is no harder job that's less fun. I mean, it's lacking. I mean, it's just so sad and lonely of an existence to be a single parent, and go out there and help single parent, help them garden, and don't become a single parent. It is easier to work out your problems in your marriage than it is to become a single parent. So don't ever take that decision lightly, because it will be literally hell for everyone.
And I think that that idea of a support structure with children or anything else, you know, especially we talk about needing to build social structures within permaculture in order to maintain these systems and to be able to teach people how to do this work moving forward. Something Dave Jackie spoke to, and I think Larry Santoyo also talked about, that speaks some to this idea that, at least as we're sitting down to talk about it now, that we're calling permaculture in the kingdom, about being able to approach both permaculture practitioners and people of faith, whether someone happens to be both of those or just one in the moment, as a way to build bridges and build more community to connect and create outreach with others. I know that this subject has a lot of meaning for you. As you said before we began the conversation today, that, you know, this is what you're embodying 24 hours a day. Just this piece of the conversation that we'll have today is only such a small part of the work that you're doing. So I was wondering if you could share with us why this idea of being able to communicate across the lines of faith is so important, and how you came to have this understanding of that dialogue.
As a single mom or a parent in general, it is so easy to become isolated, and it's so hard to ask for help. And so if you don't have a religion, how else do you connect with people down at the brewery? I mean, yeah, that's fun, but it's not really good to be going off to the brewery all the time. But what I found is I got involved with, when I was single and that other permaculture person, I got involved for a while with the Mormon church. And this was my first, oh my gosh, I can't believe this. Because, again, being very anti-religious and then hearing a couple things that, you know, they were supposed to be sort of vegan because their word of wisdom says only eat meat in cold of winter and times of famine and everything, and the principles, and all of a sudden you'd have people come visit and they cared about you, and you had all these people that kind of asked you questions, and they showed up on your door once a month and they checked in with you, and it was the first time in my life I started feeling, because he was Mormon, and so I started feeling community of people that really cared. And so I'd go to church and I'd listen to the sermons, and I thought, well, this isn't so bad. You know, sure, there's some things I don't quite get, but it's great spiritual teaching. It's like a spiritual teaching delivery method. And no matter what religion you're in or no religion, I was not a believer of anything except a lover of nature. And I really liked spiritual teachings, which are just basically the how-tos of life. Consequences, actions, and results, and setting your intentions. I've always prided myself on being a very integrous, good-natured, good-hearted person, but I definitely have that selfish point where, you know, I want my due reward. You know, I want to have a good life. I want to have great love. I want to, you know, all this kind of stuff. So I kind of missed out on some moral points there in my life because I didn't have a God that would judge me as wrong or right. So I did what I could do, and if something went wrong, I'd try to get over it and move on with my life. But so I first felt community through a faith. And my sister got involved with a faith here and just a non-denominational Christian religion. I go to church with her, and you know, it was called the Crossroads, the perfect church for people who aren't. And I said, oh, that's me, because I am definitely a sinner, and that'd be a church for me. Because I'd go to different ones to visit, and I'm like, nah, I just feel like I'm being looked at or something, you know. Anyway, and I used to tell her, I said, man, I'd love to buy into it. I'd love to get it. I'd love to have Jesus as my personal Savior. I don't know if I need saving yet, you know. And I'd just kind of joke with her, like, yeah, I'd do the hook, line, and sinker if I could, and but I won't do anything I don't believe. And just got to a point in my life where I had created so many mistakes in my life, my marriage mainly, and I was literally on my knees reveling in my own sin, basically. And I couldn't pick myself up. I'd always be able to go, oh, yeah, I messed up, and shake it off, and still not understanding where to put my heart, where to put my joy, how to find God. If I wasn't out in nature, how do I find God? So anyways, I got to that point where I was literally broken just because of my own consequences of my pursuit of happiness. And we decided to divorce. That's what it was. If you're having problems, you always fantasize about leaving a relationship until, you know, you decide to do it. And then the shock sits in. And I told my sister, I said, okay, I'll go to that Bible study class. I need anything. And I went, and they were talking about Romans. And it's about stop putting your own personal desires for comfort or leisure or sexual pleasures or time-saving devices or electrical outlets everywhere that work 24/7, leaving your lights on, whatever. Just stop putting your physical needs ahead of everything else and put that body down as a living sacrifice on the altar and pick up the will of God and just do the will of God. And it just hit me, like, literally I had like this enlightening moment. I'm like, wow, I can stop pursuing this fruitless search of physical indulgence or wellness or whatever. It's kind of like when you take that first drink, it feels kind of good, but then you want more drink, you know, the drink takes a drink, and it's never satisfying. It's never enough. And in the meantime, you ruin relationships, you break up families, you know, you piss people off. And so I realized I had this big life review of just, that was what I was pursuing. I was pursuing this fulfillment of self. And my second thought was, you mean if I just get rid of trying to pursue this, having myself and my own needs taken care of all the time, then I can do the will of God. That means I'll just go out and serve people to help them find permaculture. And I'm like, I felt free. I'm like, yeah, I can do God's will. I can just teach permaculture all day long. I felt vindicated. I felt righteous. So that was my start.
And through that, you really saw an intersection between the earth care of permaculture and the body of community that comes together from faith practices?
I always judged people in Christianity because I felt they weren't doing enough to protect the earth. I was thinking, God, if Christians really love God's creations, then how are people standing by while corporations are totally destroying the planet? And there is a little bit of that sort of fear prejudice thing toward worshiping creation, where people kind of get that uneasy, scripture says, worship the creator, don't worship creation. When I would talk passionately about the earth or gardening or how we need to protect it or how we need to do all this, take care of, do permaculture, and they would see my passion and they say, now be careful, Kelly, don't you know, worship the creator. But I looked it up in the Bible, and that had nothing to do with the earth. It was in Romans talking about people doing idol worshiping and just toward other humans.
That idea, though, of worshiping creation was not about necessarily what was created by God, but more about these other things that get created.
It's about making idol worshiping ceremony around it. You know, yeah, if you have a pagan ceremony and you're killing a goat or something like that, yeah, I'd say that's not really cool. But it was more toward that. And then I said, well, you know, has it come from all the witch burnings and all the people freaking out about the herbalists? Do people have an issue with herbs? They're like, no, herbs are, 180 of them are mentioned in the Bible. And there's these Bible verses all over that that the food is, the medicines and the plants, it's all for us. The creation has been for us. These were God's gifts to us. All the creatures, all the species were God's gift for our abundance. That was our inheritance. And that's why I go back to people all the time. Our two most important things is capture the resources like the rain, use the resources, and bring back God's species. We are caretakers of his species, whether it's animals or creepy crawly things or birds. We have dominion, which means taking care of it, to make it so it won't kill us, but we can look to its betterment. And that's why permaculture is the number one and only best body of science that does the best thing to instruct us how to do that. And that's why I want people in permaculture to cross over the fear boundary and misperception boundary and fear of judgment and offending one way or the other, and teach Christians, let Christians discover permaculture. Somebody was saying, Jeff Lawton was saying, there are so many people who haven't heard about it, who haven't been exposed to it. He said it in a better way, that haven't been like converted in a way, but that haven't come into that knowledge of thinking how nature does it. And oh, it's going back to the whole witch thing and the herbalist being killed by religious people. And they said, well, that was because these people were attributing the magical powers of creation and God's creation to themselves and not giving glory to God for that. And sure, there could have been some of that in some instances, but you know, they definitely, you know, you can't judge Christians by what people have done in the name of Christianity. You have to go to what the pure essence of Christ's teachings and the whole essence of, you know, love, forgiveness, and a spiritual life, and focusing on what God would want, which is total care of all the creatures and each other.
That was one of the important things that came out of my conversation with Ramis Kent, which I have to thank you for recommending him as someone to speak to as part of this series. But one of the things that he spoke to was about needing to decouple the faith and the faith practices from the politics and actions that occur in the name of faith, but that are not necessarily done from a place of faith.
Well, you look at people that say, oh, Christians, they're so judgmental. I don't want to be around them. It's all over the Bible. Do not judge. That is God's job. If people are doing something that's not working, that's between them and God. You only have to deal with between you and God. You know, that's where the judgment is. And yeah, you'll feel it the more tuned in you are. You'll feel where something's not a right thought or something's not a right action. And, you know, in the permaculture world, we talk about observe and interact and self-regulate. The other thing that I wanted to really impress upon people is that, you know, they talk about how few our numbers are as permaculturists and how we really need more permaculture teachers and we really need more permaculture consultants. There is a church in every neighborhood. There are Christians living around you. There are 3 billion Christians on the planet. And these are people who live and die for God and to serve God, and that means to serve one another and to serve the world. And yes, people are at all levels in their walk and their faith. Some people are much more human and they're much more stuck in their sins, or they're much more stuck in paths that are having destructive ends. It's very difficult to get anyone to turn away from that. When you start turning away from those things that end in destructive ends, whether it's not recycling your waste or living in cities and contributing to city sewage systems, that weighs heavily on my mind. Everything going down my sink is going into our river, which is going down to Oregon. But there's so many people. And the whole principle of tithing, it's not anywhere in the New Testament that you have to tithe 10%, but it's generally accepted that that's kind of the idea. You give what you can. It's the same thing in permaculture with returning the surplus. You give whatever surplus you have that'll go back into serving that community, that those needs. And so you have people that have lands. You have people that have tools and machinery that are all part of this body. They call the church is not the building, the church. It's the body of people who love Christ and serve God and try to be more Christ-like. And so you've got these people with this give attitude and this give mentality. And yes, I will share my time. I will share my resources. So you have this body of workers for the good that are just ready. They're just primed for being able to many times do their effort thousandfold of effectiveness if they had the permaculture skills and talents and abilities. And I just want to say out there to all those people who were in the same place that I was at, where I had so many resentments towards something I knew nothing about. I would try to read the Bible and it'd be this war and that war and this. And I just couldn't. I was a yoga teacher. I studied Sanskrit. I read up. I listened to Buddhism. And all these are great teachings. They're all useful and beneficial. But there's a storyline and there's a message and there's this whole, like, examples of interaction of how people fall away from God, how they suffer the consequences, how they return to God through repentance, through being sorry for what they did. And then they're blessed by being forgiven. And that's, you know, in opening their heart to Christ. And that's a dynamic that I know that non-Christians, they just hear it as words of craziness. But it is a, like I say, it's a metaphysical, mystical experience where you're now living a God life. My dad was a quantum mechanic atheist. And so he would always say, you know, think and so shall be, you know, using Bible quotes all the time to prove that thought creates things. And I always joke that if you think that this is a godless universe, you're going to get a godless universe. And if you think you've got a personal savior out there to help you every step of the way, and a God that's giving you power to make up for where you aren't courageous, is going to make you courageous, give you strength when you don't have your own strength, then you've got that. You get what you think. You get what truth you believe in. And all truth is subjective, so choose what truth you want to believe in. But just know that these Christians aren't these bad people out there judging you because you don't want to play their game, or you want to cheat on your wife and get drunk or whatever and not feel bad about it. They probably don't really want to associate with that. But it's all about being a good person. And one of the things that really hit me from one of the talks with one of your people is he said, Larry Korn, he said, it's about, you have to, doing permaculture, you have to have a sense of righteousness. And we do. We have righteousness to care for how the pigs are doing or how the rabbits are doing. I can't believe how many hours I spend trying to make rabbit habitat so I have happy bunnies.
With how big the Bible is, and as you say, you know, you were reading it before and, you know, all these wars and all these different things, how do we communicate across these lines and not get lost? I had a conversation with someone once about the Bible, and the piece came about how people can use the laws in Leviticus to speak down to someone. And I've seen people who get tattoos on their bodies of the laws from Leviticus, even though later in Leviticus, there's a law that says that you shouldn't, I forget how it is, but it's something like you shouldn't mar your body. And from that developed into a conversation of personal canon. And the idea that the Bible is so big that you can only take so much of it into your own faith practices. And I was wondering how your work and communicating across these lines, like what pieces of that do you use that listeners might refer to when trying to develop a dialogue, either, you know, among maybe perhaps people at their own church from a Christian perspective, or perhaps as an outsider who wants to engage bodies of Christian faith to have those conversations?
I've actually heard that there are certain religions that are more Genesis, creation-oriented, which is we were built in the image of God. We were put on the earth to tend the garden. When you eat from the tree of life by tending the garden, you have everlasting life. When you eat from the tree of knowledge of good and evil, which is, to me, the knowledge of judgment, you shall surely die, or the knowledge of finding out about what's good and evil. It's best just not to go there. To stay with tending the garden and tending the animals. And there are so many references in the Bible that God created so that we're content just by being fed and clothed. To find that contentment, find the contentment in very simple things. There are other people who look toward Revelation. And in Revelation, it says, from 1 hour to the next, the market, sort of mammon, or the market, like the industrial, civilized world that's been specialized in all these markets, and it's kind of like where sin abounds, but everything's available on the market. cows and trees and fine woods and linens and oils and food, from 1 hour to the next, that market will be gone. And it's so bad, people are just wishing they'd die. And this book that I literally picked up this morning at 4 o'clock, I kind of felt that, yeah, get up, you're excited for this. You know. And I went downstairs, my husband just started this book. It's called Surviving Off-Grid by Michael Bunker. I couldn't believe it. He was just writing exactly what I've been thinking and feeling, but puts it into great words, and it's written. So please, everybody, pick that up, Christian or not, because it goes over and over into, you know, 100 years ago with our great-grandparents, if the electricity would have stopped, they would have been fine. And in two generations, three generations, now if the electricity went out for a year, probably 95%, 75% of the population of the planet would die. So his big saying is that it's not only about getting off-grid and keeping our comforts and, you know, having our solar panels, which is nice if there are some things that we can help us in the transition period to get off-grid and get off of this mammon, this industrial, you know, it's kind of like the mark of the beast type of thing. You know, they're always worried about, are we going to have to put chips in our kids just to get food? You know, are you going to accept the mark of the beast for your kid if it means you eat or not? You know, and so many people get sent to industrial food systems. And the most important thing we have to do is get our families, like Bill Mollison talks about all the time, get our families so that they could survive without electricity. They could survive without the trucks coming in. I live up here in Montana, and everything's trucked in the wintertime. And I've been telling people for years, hey, what would you do if the trucks stopped coming? And slowly, we're in this energy decline. The only reason why we're not feeling peak oil now is because they're making a mess out of Canada with the tar sands, and they're doing all this fracking, destroying water systems in American communities and sucking out all their water that they don't have to be sucking out. So that's why we're not feeling the whole peak oil thing. But if we hadn't had that, we would all be on energy descent. I think the transition movement is so important, which came out of permaculture, which helps us to be able to cross those cultural lines in our communities and set up our communities as a transition. This would be Transition Polson or Transition Missoula is a group, or your area. And it's based on three: local food security, local labor exchange, and local energy independence. And that's if you're in a town. But this book is proposing that, well, that's great, and we should have been doing that 20 years ago and getting everybody localized and getting off stuff that's imported, you know, if we can help it. But this guy is saying we need to get off our need for electricity. Paul Wheaton has been really trying to do a lot with a rocket mass heater, and everybody says, well, you know, why don't you just put a squirrel cage fan on the outside and suck any air out that might back smoke? And he's like, well, I don't want it to be dependent on a system. We have to come up with a system dynamically that will work in any situation without an exterior source. So this is what the whole thing is. And there's a saying in the Bible that from Jeremiah 6:16, I think, it says, thus saith the Lord, stand ye in the ways and see and ask for the old paths. Where is the good way? And walk therein, and you shall find rest for your souls. But then they said, and you know, the Bible's wrought with what happens when they don't do what God says. He says, well, we will not walk therein. And it's the hardest thing. I talk to even all my Christian friends, and I say, how many of you are still paying $80 a month for television? Mm-hmm. You know, it's the worst distraction. It's totally biased. It's totally co-opted by corporations. Your kids shouldn't be exposed to it.
But when it comes for people to take action with connecting with others, it sounds like what we need to do, whether we're members of a body of faith or coming to it from the outside, is that a big part of it is understanding the audience who we're going to be speaking to and what pieces of the Bible their tradition connects with, in order to be able to go in and speak to them, well, to borrow from Ethan Hughes, not to speak to them, but to meet them where they're at and introduce these ideas of ecological design in the way that it ties into faith practices. Is that a fair enough interpretation?
Sure, it's part of one. What you really need to talk to also and remind Christians that we are to be in the world but not of it. And it's very comfortable, you know, at church, people are always chastised for being armchair Christians, where they go to church on Sunday, they feel good, and then they go back to their lives, and they find their forgiveness and fill back up on God on Sunday, and they're not separating themselves from this industrial life. This book really talks about it as the industrial womb, where you get everything on time, that way for the adversarial forces, as they say, to keep you off of doing your more important work, your God work, which is uncomfortable. Like somebody said, gosh, when I became Christian, I thought life would become better, but it's become harder. And yeah, it's not supposed to be a cozy, cushy path. It's full of internal joy, but you got to get out there and go do the work, even if you don't feel like it. And the one really big thing is that it's hard to get people to show up to classes, whether it's Christian or not, community or not. And the important thing is that it's about fellowship with God's creation. And if you really press that, hey, we're here to steward God's creation, and I'm going to teach you about all these species that do these wonderful things, and talk about how the first thing that man did when he was created in the garden was to name the species. Well, we don't know any names of the species. We don't even walk on grass barefoot. We get into our cars and drive down the road and get back in our houses, and we have no interaction with species. So you got to learn to name the species and know what they do and what they need, and to recover that knowledge is huge. And people know, I mean, if you talk to any Christian about how difficult times are, there's a gut fear. And we're taught not to fear, that God will provide a way, that we'll figure this out. There's a whole bunch of promises that God makes that people find comfort in, and God's abundance is there, that he's given us the land, that, you know, we're there to work it, that if we follow God's will, then a way will be provided for us through these dark times. And those are the kind of things that you talk to in permaculture is, this is the way. This is the way that your family, you talk about family, you talk about talking about the generations. What's your legacy? That is a huge point. What kind of legacy are you going to leave behind? Because we come into this world and leave this world without stuff. So what kind of legacy, and how can you use the resources that you have right now to start getting off of the ship that's sinking, that surely ends in death, and get on to something that your chances are greater because you're living what God designed you for, which is taking care of creation, growing your own food, growing your own fibers, all the stuff that Eric Tonesmeyer talks about. Look at financial permaculture. Somebody was saying, oh, you know, we can't put the land first because that doesn't speak to the people. You got to put people care first, because if you talk about how they'll be able to make money from their piece of land, or they'll be able to feed themselves and save money from their piece of land, you talk money, and then, oh, you can get people's attention. And unfortunately, that has become the language. But there are all these other values that people in the Christian world know when you say it's the value of God's creation, it's the value of God's resources. And we're here to properly manage God's resources. And that's where permaculture comes in so powerfully.
Then taking these ideas of communication and understanding one another in order to open up a dialogue, what would be your call to action for the listeners, both of faith and not?
Well, I'd say, first of all, like I said, you have to take care of your family. You have to figure out who is your community. The most important thing is to realize that this world does not supply what you really need. You need to create your own world. You need to create your own community. You need to be with people that are like-minded. A lot of these Christians, they would love to go off with their Christian friends and have a community where they don't have to drive their kids to some school. They don't have to deal with persecution from others who don't understand them. Just like any other person, like people in permaculture, we'd love to start communities. You're going to have to change laws. You're going to have to change laws on gray water and on composting your waste. And there's so many things that call to action. I say, hey, Christians, call your senators. Tell them that we want ecological living. Find out what that is. Find out what laws don't make sense. I mean, look at the Farm Bill. Really study, talk to them, because all these insane industrialized food systems are going to be setting the standards for even the small farmer, and because of USDA standards of slaughters and all that, you can't just grow your food and sell it. It'll be regulated. So You know, we have a government that's regulating the freedoms right out of us. And freedom starts in your mind, and it frees you from going to what right now you're being told to do. And a friend of mine said, you want to have a life-transforming thing following God? Just do everything that God tells you to do for the next 30 days and don't do anything that you want to do. Just laughed because I thought, oh, that'd be great. I wouldn't put so much time into Facebook. I wouldn't clean the house so much. I would set up that blog. I would set up that website. I would go and organize those people, and we'd get stuff gardening set up. And right now we've got a food co-op. Montana Co-op is an online virtual farmers market to try to help consumers and producers communicate with each other. There's another kind of thing like this on a nationwide. This is why I got involved with Ramais Kent, because through this UnitedNeeds.com, this company I'm working with to try to put together worldwide funding with people's needs. And they're starting in Nigeria as a test pilot project. They want to create 24 million new farmers. And so I was trying to rally all my permaculture people saying, how can we train those 24 million new farmers instead of becoming Monsanto farmers? And luckily, the people like everything I've told them about permaculture, and they say, well, we can make it a requirement that they go through a permaculture course if they receive funding. So there are all these kind of ways that we can start getting our online permaculture training to people worldwide, and that governments will fund it. And how better than to mobilize the Christian masses around here, because it's this Christian organization that's, I mean, not organization, but the president is Christian, the organizations they're working with, there's a trust there. There's a trust that this person's going to do good and be good to their best ability. And, you know, we'll work with them if they've got some issues that are deal breakers, you know. Anyway, you can talk about people of, we are in the end days. Somebody said, in other parts of the world, they're living the apocalypse. And we just think that we've got this normalcy bias, that nothing's going to, it's too big to fail, nothing's going to change. And it's amazing that it hasn't already. So do what you can do to get your rootstock at your property, get your edible perennials at your property, get your fruit, get producing as much fruit as you can. Fruit stores, we need fruit for these kids in schools. We've got farm-to-school projects that are going. Start growing for them. Start growing for anyone you can. We've got people with cancer, and they're finding out that they need to get off anything but organic food. Grow more food. Every bit of my grass that now exists is only because we use it. Everything else has been turned into hegel beds and sheet mulch beds and food forest. And I've gotten a lot of people that have to do volunteer hours that were getting involved. Start making connections in your community with the people that have to do volunteer time, all the people in high school have to do volunteer time. We're setting up kid co-ops, getting them to bring a value-added food product into the market. And creating local food systems is the new frontier.
And there's the old adage that a fence makes for good neighbors. From my experience, I find that strawberries make for even better neighbors.
I'm so excited to garden with my neighbors this year, too. One of them works at the supermarket. They both work at the supermarket. And they said, Kelly, I want to come over and learn from you. And I said, so you're going to come help me with my garden this year? She goes, oh, yeah, that's great. And the other one did, too. And she goes, I want to plant corn. I said, oh, I got a total great corn spot for you. And she just lit up. And they just both inspired me. And that's where God is. That's that whole, like in yoga, we say namaste. That means when I'm in the God in me and you're in the God in you, we're one. We're in God together. And that's that fellowship that Christians share, is we can just look at each other and laugh and smile and cry just because we're basking in the love of God and Christ, and we're forgiven. And that's one last night I just want to say on the whole religious part, is that we carry so much guilt within us that it disables us to feel like we're worthy to do action to build community. You know, we carry these wounds of our past, one way or another, that have been done to us, or that we've done, or both. And it's so debilitating, and that's why, whatever it is, if you feel like you can't get out there into the community and feel good about yourself to talk to people, sit down and, gosh, pull up podcasts from Joyce Myers, you know, Battlefield of the Mind. She's got a great book called Love Revolution. And it's like, you just have to find out the value that you are, which if you look at yourself, not from your eyes, but from God's eyes, and you see how absolutely precious and absolutely important, how you're made in the image of God, and yeah, you've failed, you can be forgiven, you can let all that go, and then be whole, stop thinking about yourself, and think about how you can serve other people. That's the best way to get rid of your problems, is don't think about yourself. Just figure out how you can go help someone else.
Well, thank you for bringing us to that place. I think it's a nice note to end on, but I also always like to provide a space for any last thoughts. Do you have any as we bring this conversation to a close?
Just that it's really important to gather. There's a quote I had in here in my fabulous list of notes. Whether it's your online support, I know a lot of people Facebook, and you don't know who's out there appreciating what you have or not. Put a shout out. Say, who's really interested in doing something like this with me? Who's interested? Put some ads out in the paper. Figure out how you can gather in community, how you can start building community of like-minded people around you. A lot of these sort of prepper websites talk about, you know, you need 33 talented people in these different fields to go off and do a community that can be self-sufficient, you know, that can function. And you do. You need people. We're not meant to survive on our own. And so even if you don't really vibe on the immediate neighborhood or community, try to find the like-minded, like-hearted people that could work together, whether Christian or not. They could respect your God. You could respect their God. That's why I wanted Ramiz to come in, because I feel like permaculture is the paradigm, the operating program that will enable all of us, whether you're Christian or Islamic or Buddhist or Hindu, it will allow everybody to be able to coexist in peace. Because just like you support the pig or the horse or the goat or the plants or whatever, you're making good environment for all these people. And there's that ethical people care and earth care and reinvestment in the first two. And it's the system that's God blessed. And it's how we were built, and it's natural, and it's wonderful. But do what you can. If you live in a city, man, come to Montana. We got lots of land out here, and we need people to come join communities with us. You know, look us up on Permaculture Montana on Facebook and get out of Dodge. Find who your people are. Get to where you want to be, in case that's where you have to stay. And if you're in a place that's polluted or that you don't feel safe for your family, do everything you can to find a different place that's safer and better.
Well, thank you, Kelly, for sitting down with me and having this conversation. The Faith and Earth Care series, even though Ramiz was only the first to have gone out, while we're preparing to put this together as the second in that series, it's proving to be very popular. I've received a lot of responses from folks who want to hear more, and I'm very glad that you would join me and add your voice to that conversation. So thanks for sitting down with me and recording this today.
Thank you. And I just had that one last thought I remembered that was so important. I did say it a little bit earlier in the time, but it's in Revelations. It talks about that the fall of the kingdom will come when the people become offended by each other. And that's why I really want people, Christian and non-Christian, to bridge that gap and do everything you can to not be offended from each other. Give that offense up to God and let that be, you know, soothed for you. But it's important not to basically make someone else fall because of offense, of being offended.
Well, we'll share this message with the world and help people communicate with one another more openly and use that to build community.
Thank you so much for your good work. And please, I hope everybody listens to every single one of your podcasts at least twice.
And that was Kelly Ware. If you haven't listened to it yet, I suggest you go back and listen to the interviews with Larry Santoyo and Dave Jackie. The two of them spoke about the engagement we as permaculture practitioners need in order to grow the so-called invisible structures, to make permaculture more viable, and to put the systems in place that are necessary to foster and see continue the on-the-ground landscape designs. With her personal experience in the body of the community of the faithful, I think that Kelly's approach can be incredibly useful in those pursuits. And though I haven't, and won't, speak about my own faith tradition, or a lack thereof, on air, I have applied many of the ideas that Kelly presented to engage like-minded individuals and organizations locally. Meeting people where they're at makes a huge difference. Find the common ground and talk in that space. The rest will follow. If you'd like to talk to me about our common ground, or even where we disagree, feel free to send me an email show@thepermaculturepodcast.com or give me a call, 717-827-6266. As this episode is part of the Faith and Earth Care series, the next piece on this topic will be the second part of my conversation with Ramiz Kent about Islam and Earth Care on March 18, 2014. Then my friend Paul Tomkiel, a Lutheran vicar, will speak about the Christian theology of Earth Care on April 8, 2014. But those are many weeks away. In the meantime, I'll be releasing a review of the book Regenerative Enterprise, Optimizing for Multicapital Abundance by Ethan Rowland and Gregory Landwa. And the next interview will be with Dr. John Kitsteiner to discuss permaculture and our health. With one quick update and a small request, we'll bring this episode to a close. On March 8, 2014, I'll be attending the A Gathering of Farmers Conference at Wilson College in Chambersburg, Pennsylvania. Not only will I be attending, I'm also going to be a presenter doing a workshop on Permaculture 101. If you can make it out, I would love it if you can join us, and I look forward to seeing you there. For that event, the keynote speaker is Brian Snyder, the Executive Director of PASA, the Pennsylvania Association for Sustainable Agriculture. Entertainment is going to be provided by Reverend Billy and the Stop Shopping Choir. And all in all, I think it should be a good time, and I'm quite looking forward to it. I'll be bringing my friend and photographer John along to take plenty of pictures to share with you after the event. And the last bit for this show, can you do two things for me? If you know someone interested in permaculture, share the show with them. And also, please post a review on iTunes or on whatever service you use to download this show. It really helps to get the word out. And that brings this episode to its end. Until the next time, take care of the earth, yourself, and each other. And that little bit of legal. The Permaculture Podcast is released under Creative Commons, Attribution, No Derivatives, Non-Commercial License. Feel free to share it with whoever you want. Just tell them where you got it from, and don't change or sell it.